want the, something from the scripture?
Okay, sure.
Well, there is a one small passage from the songs composed by Prophet Zarathustra in the ancient language, which is also known as the Avesta language. And basically, it's in the beginning of his scriptural songs. Ayaya sao nemangao, ustan jasto rafedriao, manye usmazdao paurvim, spentaya sha vispeng shautanao, vange us kratum manangaho, yakhas nevishao geuscha urvanem. Raising my hands in humbleness, I first ask for all the righteous actions and wisdom of the good mind, of the unseen and prosperity bringer wise God, so that I may bring happiness to the soul of the world.
So as has been our tradition at Fairview Community Church, we welcome guests of religious traditions to share with us a little bit about their faith. And so we sit down with Manik Bujwala and ask you a couple of questions about the Zoroastrian faith. Now these questions come in from those of us in our congregation, and so you're always encouraged to send those in, and you'll have an opportunity after the service to ask some extra questions. But we're just going to go right ahead and begin. And so you mentioned this earlier. I knew of your religion as named Zoroastrianism,
right.
But I've also heard it pronounced Zarathustrianism.
Right. Or Zarathustri religion.
Zarathustri.
Right.
And I've also heard that some people call it Mazdaism.
Yeah, because, you know, the name that Prophet Zarathustra used for addressing God was Ahura Mazda, you know, which means the wise God or wise Lord. And so Mazda is wisdom. Ahura is like the Lord or spiritual leader. So, yeah, so people use different names. Sometimes people even use another word called Dine Vangui, which means the good religion. You know. So there are many ways. But the most common is, you know, in our language, it would be called the Zarathustri religion, which means the religion of Zarathustra. And in the English part of it, it's called Zoroastrianism.
And so you mentioned when you were talking with the kids earlier that this tradition is so old, it's between 4 and 6,000 years old.
Right. So,
can you tell us about how it came to be and, of course, where it came
to be? Well, basically, Prophet Zarathustra is believed to have been born and lived in the eastern part of the Iranian plateau, and that could be, you know, because the greater Iranian lands go all the way up to the Central Asia, you know, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, you know, some of those places. And now, as I said before, during his time, you know, now you had the origin of the people. They came from, they are called the Aryans, and they came from somewhere in the Caucasus area, this southern Russia, and they migrated down probably during the Ice Age, you know, towards a less, more comfortable climate. And so some of them settled in the Iranian lands, and some of them went further down to settle in Afghanistan, India, you know, etc., those places. And there was a lot of fighting going on between these Aryan tribes in those days, at least during the time of Zarathustra. And there was a lot of, you know, tyranny and suffering. And so in the first part of the songs of Zarathustra, he says that, you know, the soul of the world cries out to God, saying, you know, send us some savior, you know, who can deliver us from this suffering and tyranny and all that. And so that's how God decides to send Zarathustra. He chooses him as the only one who can deliver his message. So actually the religion is from God, but it is delivered by the messenger, you know, Zarathustra.
So I have learned that Zoroastrianism is a dualistic tradition. Can you explain more about that? Maybe more about your cosmology and deities?
Yeah, sure. Actually, it is a big, you can consider it a monotheistic religion because we believe in one God, okay? But there is the ethical dualism, okay? So in this relative world where we live in, there's always two opposites, you know. You have a light and darkness, you have sweet and sour, you know, and you have good and evil, okay? Now, the evil is, of course, a very difficult concept, you know, as to how does it get started and all that kind of thing. But the way it is explained in our religion is that evil is the rejection of God's, you know, law or God's will, okay? So when we do things that are wrong, okay? In Prophet Zarathustra in the beginning, you know, he says, listen to me carefully with your, you know, attentive mind, and then you ponder on what I have said, try to understand, you know, so kind of like a meditation, understand, and then you have to choose, you know, what is the right thing to do in your day-to-day life or special events, etc. And so when we decide to go the wrong way, okay, and that is what we would call as something evil. Okay. And so evil is not does not have an existence of its own, but it is a parasitic entity, you know, that comes about through deficiency or you know, some kind of rejection of God's law.
So it's not personified, or is there a legend or myth about that? Because I had learned about Ahura Mazda and Angramanu in a cosmic, eternal battle.
Right.
Is that a myth?
Well,
or
now there are
not that myth isn't true, of course.
Right, but there are many you know, books written by followers of Zarathustra. But basically, you know, some people will personify it because that's the way we, you know, on most of the people understand with some personification. But the concept is that in our own mind, you know, we have this good thinking and wrong thinking. And so Angramanu is kind of like the entity that, you know, gives us bad thoughts or wrong thoughts. And they, you know, the other Spentamanu is the progressive spirit or progressive mind, you know, which leads us to the good thing. Yeah, that's how it is.
Now, historically speaking, at least in my studies, we've learned that Christianity actually borrowed some of this and potentially completely misunderstood it, I'm sure.
Right.
But in our understanding of creation of our own dualism, this idea of God versus Satan, or Jesus versus Satan.
Right.
And we've linked that to an influence of Zoroastrianism. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? And do you think we've just completely misunderstood your tradition?
No, I think that, you know, all religions, you know, all messengers, in fact, in my understanding, they derive, you know, we all get the faculty of thinking, the faculty of the inspiration that comes from the divine, you know, spirit, the God, you know, we call it. But we also learn from other people, you know, who have come before us, you know, and this happens in physical science, you know, where other scholars have discovered, scientists have discovered things, and we borrow from that and incorporate that and then add to that. And so the prophets also, they had learned something from the previous religions, and I'm sure Zarathustra, he was supposed to be also a priest in the old religion. And, you know, he probably, you know, took some, learned some things from the previous religion. And then, you know, through his own insight, meditation, etc., you know, he gave us some more insight. So same way, Christianity, you know, I'm sure Jesus Christ, or at least that's the way I understand, Jesus Christ, you know, got the divine inspiration directly from God. But also he was a human being. And, you know, he was going around traveling, and there's some book about, you know, the missing years of Jesus Christ, where he may have traveled to different lands, etc. And so he may have definitely, you know, borrowed, learned certain things from the previous religions like the Zoroastrian religion. But I don't think it's a misunderstanding. You know, it's still the same ideas, you know, and sometimes people personify things, you know, as Satan and, you know, as the opposite of God. But it's really our own mind, you know, which is fighting between our good and evil impulses, you know.
So the personification was part of a myth in order to help people understand.
Right, exactly.
And so our tradition is the same. We have a lot of the myth that some people take as literal truth and other people see as the vehicle to greater understanding about what's happening in our own psyche and in our world. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about the major tenets of Zoroastrianism and the scripture? Okay. Is it all from Zarathustra or is it...
Well, basically, the major tenets of our religion are that God has given us a free will, you know, freedom of choice, okay? And that we are supposed to use our good mind to think about, you know, things and to understand God's will and to try to live in this world according to that. And, you know, basically, we have these same ethical teachings that you find in most other religions of being truthful. Truth is a very important concept in our religion. Being charitable, being kind, not only to human beings, but also to all other creations of God. And Prophet Zarathustra, in his songs, he specifically mentions about taking good care of our animals, you know, and not to destroy them in fun or, you know, sport, something like that. And so basically, and then what we have is the concept of moral accountability, okay? So if we, depending on what choice we make, we are going to get the consequence. You know, it's kind of like the law of karma or the law of physics, you know, where every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So if we touch a hot object like a hot stove or something, you're going to feel some burning on your skin, okay? You can't just say, well, forgive me, and, you know, you won't get any burning type of thing. So with the freedom of choice, we have the responsibility and the consequence of the action. But we do not have the concept of eternal damnation, okay? So in our religion, we believe that all the souls, eventually, you know, they will learn from their experience in life, the suffering that they cause to themselves by making the wrong choices. And then eventually, at the end of time, everything will be made perfect. And, you know, there is a concept of resurrection, which again, you know, might have been borrowed in Christianity.
Well, that I wanted to skip ahead to the question that asks, what happens after you die? And is there a concept of an afterlife? And is it in phases or is it all one?
There is no specific mention of what kind of place, except the Prophet talks about it, that if you live a good life, you will be, you know, going to the house of songs, you know, which is near God or merge with God, you know, basically. But there is no other, I mean, there is the concept of heaven and hell in the sense that heaven is a place where, you know, your soul is going to be happy, and hell would be the temporary place where, you know, or mind, or suffering of your mind or soul. That's what. But there's no specific thing as to whether we will be actually reincarnated in this world to go and, you know, endure whatever consequence we have, or go to some other planet. There's nothing specific has been mentioned.
Okay, well, I had learned, and maybe I'm just completely incorrect, and I would like my money back from Chapman University, because I spent a lot of money on it.
Right.
Why don't you explain to me? I had heard perhaps it's a legend and a myth in order to enact our greater self-awareness of our own self-will, but that we'll come to a moment where when we die, we'll be asked to walk across the Chinvat Bridge.
Okay, good.
And at that point, the bridge will be wide and easily tread because we've lived a good life and we've made important ethical decisions, or the bridge will be rickety and we'll have a problem, and that potentially even the bridge itself will force us down, and we'll live in, and we'll be destined to the chasms of a hell of some sort, where Angramanyu is the lord of that region.
Right.
Is that simply myth?
The concept of that bridge, you know, that our soul after we die, and again, we have the belief that for 3 days and nights, you know, the soul kind of hovers around the earth, and that's why we have certain prayers, you know, for 3 days and nights. And on the dawn of the fourth day, fourth morning, is when the soul ascends, you know, towards this place we call the bridge of the separator, you know, between the physical and the spiritual world, which is called Chinwat Pool. And there we face our judgment, you know. And again, this is kind of partly to make people understand that, you know, there is a consequence that you will be judged, you know. But the prophet himself does not go into that kind of specifics, you know, of the bridge of separator and all that. But in our scriptures, it is mentioned to be able to make people understand, you know, and remember that there is a consequence and that you will be judged after your physical life.
Okay. Thank you. This is very similar to Christianity in that we have many ideas about what happens, but when we look sort of at a more philosophical standpoint, it's often teaching about how to live our lives and gives us examples, and we use that metaphor to become better human beings.
Exactly.
Thank you. That's so informative.
Sure.
Let me go back to one of these others. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I talked about this together, but Christianity is sort of inherently an evangelistic tradition, and so most Christians tend to try to convert, mm-hmm. and so they're out trying to grow the religion and convert. Is your tradition a conversion tradition?
Well, in the time when Prophet Zarathustra, you know, was living, obviously he was teaching his you know, new religion, his new teachings to the people who listened to him. And he also told his followers to go and spread the word, you know, of the new religion, which at that time was the best, you know, religion according to people. And so there was a, you know, people were going around and teaching people, but there was no force used. They were, you know, whoever listened, they were taught about this, and people who liked it, you know, they basically followed those teachings, okay? So, but then, you know, later on, and this is, of course, mostly in the Iranian area where the religion, and the Persian Empire, you know, when Persian Empire was established by Cyrus the Great in about 525 BC or 539 BC or so, he basically was a follower of the Zoroastrian religion. So, you know, most of the Persian Empire, the population, the majority did follow the Zoroastrian religion. But there were other religions, you know, at that time. By that time, you had Christianity, you had the Jewish religion. And as a matter of fact, Cyrus the Great, you know, he liberates the Jewish people from captivity in Babylon when he conquers Babylon, and also gives them money to rebuild their church, you know, in Jerusalem. By the way, there is a clay cylinder that on which the Cyrus the Great has inscribed what is known as by scholars as the oldest human rights declaration. And that is currently on display at the Getty Museum, some of you would like to go and take a look at it. The original is in the British Museum, and it's currently on loan from the British Museum, and a copy of it is also in the United Nations building. And Jefferson and some of the founding fathers read about how Cyrus the Great, you know, administered his empire. So, but yeah, basically the religion, nowadays we do not have the tradition of converting people. We do, you know, welcome people in our center, Zoroastrian center, and if they want to learn about our teachings, they are welcome to do that. And many of the Iranian Muslims, you know, who have come to the United States and other countries in Denmark and other Australia and other, when they learn about their ancient religion, they are very impressed by it, many of them, and they basically decide to go back to the religion, you know, the ancient religion, because the way the Islam is taught in or practiced in Iran has frustrated many of those people, and so they feel that this may be a very more simple and straightforward religion.
So So tell us a little bit about how you worship, when you worship. Do you observe a Sabbath as we do? Tell us about your religious practice.
Okay. Basically, we can go to our temple, or we can pray at our home from the prayers that we have, the scriptures. But then we also have priests who are ordained, who go through a very rigorous training, especially in India and in Iran, and they perform certain ritual ceremonies that are requested by members of the community, like Thanksgiving ceremony that we call Jashan. I myself was ordained over here in the U.S., and some people call me to do a Thanksgiving ceremony when they buy a new house or a condo or apartment, or just for any particular occasion, And so we basically do a ritual prayer where we thank God and thank His good creations. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, we do have at this center over here, we have another center in the city of Orange. This one originally was established in Westminster, and the other one we established a couple of years ago. And we have a religious service on Sunday mornings usually. Mm-hmm. And then we have like the six gaham bars, or seasonal festivals, spring, mid summer, fall, autumn, winter, etc. And where again we as a community we get together, and the original idea was that the whole community, rich and poor, they get together, the rich people share their wealth, help the poor people of the community, and we all thank God together and by doing certain ritual prayers. And then during the funeral, after a person dies, we have three nights of prayers, at God's creation, spiritual creation called Sarosha. It's kind of like an angel or archangel concepts that we have in our religion. And so those prayers are done, funeral prayers also. Wedding, when there is a wedding, there is again a ritual ceremony where people are united under religious auspices.
And you mentioned prayer earlier, and again, of course, right now. Right. And I think that you may have mentioned you pray five times a day.
Right.
And you mentioned with the children that you use fire when you're inside, and then outside we can look towards the sun, any life-giving.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, basically, one of the teachings from our prophet was to do certain prayers, remember God, think about God, and do certain prayers, which again remind us to be a good person. Why is it five times a day? I think the concept is because in our day-to-day life, we get so engrossed in the material part of life, in cutthroat competition, whether it is in the workplace or any other place, that we do need a constant reminder to keep us, kind of calm us down from our worry, anxiety, all the jealousy, all those bad feelings we have, and again bring us back toward our spiritual. So kind of create a balance between the physical life, material life, and the spiritual life. And so five times a day prayer is a suggestion. We believe that the Muslims in Islam, this five times a day prayer was probably also learned by Prophet Muhammad, because he had a very close friend called Salman al-Farsi, or Salman the Persian. Mm-hmm. And his tomb is supposedly there in the city of Baghdad, Iraq area, somewhere in that area. Now, he was originally a Zoroastrian priest who had traveled, and at one time he became a Christian or followed the Christian religion. Then he was sold into slavery in the Jewish tribe in Mecca or Medina or those places, and then he met Prophet Muhammad, and he taught him about the teachings of the Zoroastrian religion. So we believe that some of the things, the Prophet Muhammad may have learned from him.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Thank you. You spoke about this with the kids, so I'm just going to mention it. But the ritual wear or holy garments that you have, mentioned the shirt and the
woolen thread.
The thread. Is there anything else that you would mention for us?
Well, basically, there are, of course, ritual implements that our that we use or the priests use in their ceremony. The concept of purity is very important, you know. So again, our priests, you know, we wear completely white clothes. And the idea is that, you know, on the white clothes, you can notice any speck of dust or dirt very easily, whereas in other colored clothes, you may not. And then we wear a cap, and I understand the cap. The idea is so that our hair, you know, which sometimes has a habit of falling, that it will not contaminate the place where we are doing our prayers. You know? So, and then, of course, the priests have certain other ritual implements that they use besides the fire urn and the fire.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Where do women fit in okay. this tradition?
Well, women are originally, women, you know, have always had a place of equal respect, okay? The prophet Zarathustra, in his songs, as well as in our later scriptures, we always talk about the good men and the good women, okay? In his teachings, Prophet Zarathustra actually gives an example of his youngest daughter, whose name was Pauruchista, as a example of a good person, okay? So he does not differentiate or give preference to men over women. It just happened that in the many of the societies, you know, in the ancient world as well as in today's world, we have the patriarchal system, you know, where men are they have been traditionally the people who go out and work and all that. But it wasn't always so. In the farms, you know, men and women both work hand to hand, you know, hand in hand together. And so in our religion, the concept of women is equality. Now, so far, traditionally, the priests have been men, okay? Women, the reason why they say the women were not encouraged because during certain periods when the a young woman, you know, until her age of menopause, etc., you know, there is a certain condition that would create impurity in the atmosphere, you know, the release of blood, etc. And even if a male priest, you know, if he gets a cut on his hand and if there is a bleeding, you know, then he cannot do the prayers, you know. So the idea was connected with the concept of keeping purity in the atmosphere. But nowadays, actually, young women are also being allowed to become priests. Okay. So it's changing.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, we like women ordained
right.
over here. Right. Now, what's important for our church, I'm not even sure if this would be an issue for uh-huh. For your tradition,
right.
but certainly in the United States today, it's important for us. We are intentionally, we call ourselves an open, welcoming, and affirming congregation, mm-hmm. which means that we welcome all people, and we have a specific intentional welcome to those who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, this is sort of a modern
right.
issue.
Right.
What does your tradition think about that? Do you have any stance on homosexuality? Is it ever discussed? What does it mean today that it's discussed politically here right. in California and throughout the United States?
Right. Well, as you said, it is a modern issue in the sense that people have become more aware of it, they discuss it, they practice certain things openly. From ancient times, you know, there have been people know that there have been some people who have had homosexual tendencies and they have, you know, done things, sexual practices like that. But these were not given too much importance or attention. Traditionally, we believe that, you know, we should learn from nature, you know, and, you know, in nature, usually you don't find that much homosexuality between animals and all that. And so
penguins.
We consider that a heterosexual union is a normal thing. And because also we believe that we have to, God's will to, you know, create, procreate, you know, have children and all that. And usually you can have children in a normal heterosexual relationship. So there is no hatred of anyone, you know, because we are supposed to love all human beings. But we consider that heterosexual union is a more normal practice.
And do you think that will change as time
well,
changes?
Well, I mean, people, you know, we don't ask people, are you homosexual, you know, when they come to our church. You know, whatever they are, they come to church, you know, and of course we would not encourage, you know, signs of, you know, people kissing each other, you know, in the church, that type of thing, especially if they are homosexuals, you know, because we want to create a good example to our children, you know, it is what is normal, what is, you know, what is a better thing to, you know.
Yes, so I suppose there we would probably differentiate because we do think that it's normal, and if you want to give your loved one a kiss, go for it.
I mean, just my understanding.
Oh, I understand. Thank you. Let's see, where am I at here? One of our last ones, are there rituals that happen at birth, like a Jewish circumcision or a christening? And are there rituals that occur at certain ages?
You have, well, we do not have a ritual at birth, but when a child is able to understand some things and is able to recite our prayer, some short prayers, like the prayer where we untie and tie the woolen thread around our white shirt, you know, inner shirt. Then the children are taught, you know, like maybe around the age of 7 or 9, roughly. For the girls, they usually try to do it earlier, because what happens, the priest puts on this white shirt on the body. You know, originally they take a ritual bath, and then they are covered with a shawl type of thing on the upper body. And then the priest will put the white inner shirt on them. And then, you know, both the priest and the initiate will basically recite the prayer. And basically they are doing an affirmation of faith that I choose this religion of Zarathustra, you know, and that I will follow his teachings, you know, that kind of thing. So that's the initiation ceremony, which is called Navjot, or the new beginning, something like that, new life, okay? And then, of course, the wedding, as I mentioned, you know, people are, again, united in a religious ceremony. They also, the ceremony is done in front of a fire, a sacred fire. And then you have the funeral ceremonies, you know, where we do other prayers.
Thank you. Sure. Well, our final question is usually the same, and our final question is, what is the most important thing that Christians or non-Zoroastrians should know about your religion?
Well, basically, they should know that we are also, we believe in one God, and we believe in all the good, living a good life or ethical life, not hurting anyone. One of the things, it says, Usta amai, usta kamai chit, happiness to him who brings happiness to others, you know. And we do not have the distinction that when we pray to God for goodness, for good health, etc., we do not say that it is only for Zoroastrians. We pray for the whole world, you know, and that we respect all other religions as being messengers of God, because we have this concept of saviors coming, you know, from time to time, which is mentioned by Prophet Zarathustra himself. You know, from time to time in different places, God will send messengers, because God is not preferential to one particular religion. Otherwise, God would not be fair and just, right? I mean, he loves all his children if we believe that the same God created all of us. And so those are some of the things. And then I forgot to mention one thing, that Judaism, as I read from some books, originally Judaism had the concept of a jealous God, an angry God, you know, and only for that tribe. And that after the Jewish people became exposed to the Zoroastrian religion when they lived in the Persian Empire, you know, when after they were released from Babylon, and many Jews continued to live in Persian Empire, that they changed their concept of a more loving God, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yes, sure. Thank you so much. Well, we share your belief that all religions lead us to a path to God, and that is why we're so blessed to have you with us, so that we can learn more about your tradition and enhance our own and our own journey. So we thank you so much. I want to also just note that Manik, you may have read this, he's the president of the Interfaith Council in Huntington Beach and Fountain Valley. Is it Westminster included too?
Basically, we call it Greater Huntington Beach, which is the nearby, you know, cities of Westminster and Fountain Valley. Of course, there is another group that has people from Garden Grove, Westminster also, I believe, and
yes, and here we are, the Newport Mesa Irvine. One of our former board members is in the congregation today, David. So hello, Reverend David. So thank you so much for being with us, and we're going to stand in our closing song. Friends, brothers, and sisters, we offer you the blessings of the one God seen through many eyes. Let us go out and carry the light.